This is George Spencer. This is Art Etc. And I'm here in Hudson with Robert Palumbo at the Pamela Salisbury Gallery at 362 and 1/2 Warren Street. And Robert has a wonderful show of his photographs going back over a number of years, and they cover a number of subjects. And I think, as we'll find out as we talk a little bit, I think I'm correct, Robert, correct me if I'm not correct. I think sort of your main concern is humanity and what happens to people under stressful situations.
Absolutely, and thank you, George, for inviting me to talk about my work today. I'm very happy to talk to you and to present this work in Hudson. Yes, I think that it's fair to say that my main subject, my main concern, has always been humanity and the different ways in which human beings react to stressful situations, react to crisis, and really react to each other. That's really, to me, what's the most important thing about photography, but also about all art and also about life in general.
You know, I do these interviews because, you know, I'm interested in a lot of things, and I like meeting people, and I like finding out what they do. But generally, there's also sort of a technical question or a couple of technical questions that I have that have to do with things that interest me. And so I'm going to start out by asking you a question of that sort, because the work I do, I'm moving it into larger formats now, and it's an interesting process to me. So my question is this: when you start to photograph something, do you have in mind the size that it's going to be?
You know, I use a lot of different kinds of cameras when mm-hmm. I photograph, you know, everything from an iPhone up to, you know, a very high resolution digital camera. And usually, if I know something is going to be bigger, or I think I might make a big print of something, I'll try to shoot at a higher resolution. But it is actually pretty random, and it's often dependent upon how much I need to carry. And
need to carry in terms of physically?
Physically carry, yeah. Like I can carry around a large camera or a small camera. In fact, recently I've been shooting with a very small point-and-shoot Japanese camera called a Ricoh, which has very high resolution. Surprisingly, that camera can make very large prints, so it's kind of the best of both worlds for me. I can choose whether to post something on Instagram with that camera or to make a 24x36 print. The technology has gotten so much better that, you know, you really can gather your photographs and then decide what to do with them.
So when you're traveling and you have a bag, I guess, with the cameras, I mean, you have a lot of lenses?
Often I do. Often I will have a bag with a lot of lenses, sure. But there are some situations where you can't really carry a lot of lenses into a place. You know, for mm-hmm. instance, I've worked a lot under war conditions where you don't really want to be burdened with a big bag full of lenses, so really you just want one camera or two cameras with as minimal burden as you can possibly muster and still get what you need to get.
And I guess you've done this for so long, you sort of know in advance what you're going to need for what you expect to find.
Yeah, I think like most photographers, you know, I have a love affair with my gear, and, uh-huh. and there are certain elements of the gear, certain cameras, certain lenses that I really consider to have personality.
Tell us a little bit about, you know, where you grew up.
Okay, sure. I was actually born in Newcastle, Pennsylvania, which is about 50 miles north of Pittsburgh.
Do you know whether Pennsylvania is going to go Republican or Democrat?
You know, I can't tell you for sure which way it's going to go. I do know that my brother and sister are Republicans, and I'm trying to figure out a way to talk to them about the election and perhaps sway them. I have certain strategies, but I haven't tried that yet.
Good luck.
Yeah,
it's a tough sell.
No, it is a tough sell. So I grew up there. I grew up in a place that was basically a city that had a population of 75 or 80,000 during World War II, and by the time I was born in the 60s, the population had gone down to like 30,000. So the steel industry, which was the heart and soul of that area, was dying out. So I was born into industrial ruin. Hence, I've always been really, I think, attracted to the visuals of industrial ruin. You know, I love Hudson's, like Basilica Hudson, and all the amazing, you know, old industry here, which I grew up grew up with in Newcastle and in Pittsburgh. Eventually, I went to film school, for graduate school, at Temple University in Philadelphia. So really, I was trained as a filmmaker and began making films there.
What got you into, attracted you to filmmaking?
You know, I've always been really attracted to storytelling. When I was an undergraduate at University of Pittsburgh, I was a writer. I had amazing teachers there, including Toni Morrison.
Oh, really?
Yale Doctorow, I had a workshop with. So I was obsessed with storytelling and writing. But film to me, when I began to discover particularly European filmmakers and different ways of telling stories through filmmaking, I became attracted to and obsessed with the idea of making films. And so I went to graduate school for film. Photography was almost a sideshow to that. I mean, I learned how to be a cinematographer during that process, but still photography was something that I just kind of did on the side. I've never taken a class in still photography.
Oh, really?
Never studied it, really. I've studied it, you know, independently. I love certain photographers and I've studied them deeply, but I've never actually had a workshop in photography.
Well, what would you have learned if you had gone and spent 2 years
That's a really good question. I mean, of course, there's the technical side of photography, which I don't think is really that complicated, you know, but there's also the process, the creative process. And I feel like, you know, it's a question I ask myself a lot because I have taught classes in filmmaking in the past, and I really want to teach classes in still photography now, and I'm trying to wrap my head around what that means. Like, I don't want to tell you how to realize your vision. I don't want to somehow steer you in a way that makes sense to me. Mm-hmm. Like, I want everyone to have their own independent vision. So right, studying photography or any creative art is kind of a mystery in a way. Like, how do you inspire creativity beyond the mere technical aspect?
Well, there seems to be sort of a tug of war between the people who want to tell you, okay, here's the conclusion, here's the answer, do this, and the people who want to open you up.
Yeah. I think that's true. I think that's true. Yeah. A crit, you know, in art school or in photography is very interesting. It's an interesting concept. You have a teacher basically critiquing your work. Now, I can understand a critique based on what your goals were in creating the work and whether or not you realized them. But the actual judgment process is something that is mysterious and you know, it's very complicated.
So you got out of film school, and then what happened?
Well, I got out of film school. I moved from Philadelphia to New York City.
In the 90s,
yeah. And I made a feature film when I was in Philadelphia, and I thought I would just keep making feature films, and I developed a couple of feature films after I came to New York, but realized that process did not really pay the bills, developing features. And, you know, I came close to getting another one off the ground a couple of times, but In the end, I gravitated more towards documentary filmmaking. Mm-hmm. At the time, documentary filmmaking was beginning to really come into its own on American television, and so I did that to make a living, and eventually worked a lot for National Geographic TV. They have a TV network that began in the late 90s, and I was sort of in on the beginnings of that. A dream come true for me, a dream that I didn't even know I had, really. A dream that brought me to Africa, to India, all over the world, with my video camera as a one-man band producer, but also with my still camera.
So you were actually sort of your own executive producer.
Essentially, yeah. I was the producer, director, field producer, cinematographer, all in one, sound person, all in one. The gear had become so small and manageable that you could do that. So I was a storyteller out there in the world, embedded with Doctors Without Borders, for instance, in Sudan and in Ethiopia, telling stories and meeting people, meeting amazing people all over the world. And that was sort of beginnings for me of the documentary filmmaking process, and the still photography went hand in hand with that.
Mm-hmm. So was that sort of a day job, and you were doing other things at the same time? Or was it just so all-encompassing?
It was pretty much all-encompassing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was my life. I mean, it was my job. I had my own independent work sort of that was in tandem with that work. But that was what paid the bills. I was hired as a producer and director to film all over the world for National Geographic.
I think you said a little while ago that, you know, you spend a lot of time looking at the work of photographers. I'm wondering who those were.
Yeah. I love some of the classic American photographers like Robert Frank. I think Robert Frank's work is amazing. You know, he was inspirational to me. I also really fell in love with the work of a more obscure British photographer named John Deacon, who was essentially a portrait and fashion photographer in England in the 50s. He was part of the group around Lucian Freud, Francis Bacon. He's taken some of the most famous portraits of Francis
Bacon. Did Freud do a painting of him?
I think Freud did a painting of him, yeah. I'm pretty sure he did. Yeah, I'm pretty sure he did. I always liked his direct style. He was someone who used the mugshot as an artistic form, which I really fell in love with, you know, at a certain point. Deacon has been inspirational to me. Robert Frank, Avedon, some of his earlier work, also the documentary work, been inspirational to me. But I've also been really into Japanese photographers. Daido Moriyama is one of my heroes, actually, who's a street photographer, a very raw style, but I really love what he does with his work, which is about combining images as much as it is about individual images.
When you say combining images, you're talking about collaging images?
Well, it's books. I mean, really, his primary art form is books. Uh-huh. So he will take, you know, thousands of his street photographs and combine them into a book. And the way that he lays them out, the way that he makes them into a story, is really fascinating to me. It's really great.
You have a show here now. And that show, which you just took me on a tour of, is really an incredible show. And to me, what one of the main things is, it seems to me that there is no subterfuge in your work. You know, you go directly at it, and you know that shows in, I think, in almost everything, and even in the work you did on the ecological effects of global warming, and I guess that was in Alaska, right?
Yes.
Did that sort of come naturally to you, or was that an evolution? Or did some of this come from, you know, some of the photographers you were just talking about, and you know, seeing something there and incorporating it? How does that process work with you?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think I have been inspired by some photographers in developing the style, but I think really where it comes from is really my approach to people. You know, I feel like if I'm with you and you've been generous enough to give me your time and let me into your life, you know, then I want to be as direct and open and clear with you as possible. The process itself, to me, of making a portrait is an extremely emotional process. It's a process that you know, I feel like I'm taking my own picture as much as I'm taking your picture when I take a picture of a person. You know, it's a collaboration between the two of us. And because of that, I want it to be a two-way street. You know, I want to express who you are and what you are through the photograph, but I want to bring myself to that too. And the only way to do that is to be very clear and direct and
so how do you do that?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of it is about creating a relationship with someone beforehand, but not always, you know. Sometimes I'll know someone really well before I take their portrait. I may know them for weeks or months even before I take their portrait. But sometimes I will have just met them and gain their trust and develop some kind of relationship with them very quickly. Mm-hmm. You know, so it really varies.
So it's sort of almost an intuitive process.
It's extremely intuitive. Yeah. It's extremely intuitive, yeah, for sure.
You know, one of the photographs that's here is of the trials in Rwanda. And the genocide trials in Rwanda. And there are a couple of people, there's a lot of people in this particular photograph, and there's two or three of them who are looking at you. How did you achieve that? You know the photograph I'm talking about.
Yes, right. That was a case in which I didn't even speak to the main character in that photograph. You know, she saw me taking pictures, and I saw her watching me take pictures. And I held up my camera basically to ask if I could take her picture, you know, and then she performed for me. She looked at me in a certain way that encompassed so much what was going on around her.
When you say she performed, I mean, I don't want to take exception, you know,
your
way of describing it, but it didn't look like performance to me. It looked like she felt a connection with you.
She felt a connection. I guess that's a better way to phrase it, for sure. By performance, I guess I mean that she wanted to be photographed. She wanted to be in this picture. She consented, and she allowed that to happen. And the expression on her face really encompasses so much of what's going on.
Yes.
Of course, behind her, there are hundreds of other people, most of them out of focus. And what's happening there is so emotional and so fraught with pain, drama. These people had gone through a genocide in which 800,000 people were murdered brutally, and they were there for justice, you know. And so what's going through her mind and what you see on her face is history and trauma, pain, but also, I think, a sense of hope that these trials are going to bring some kind of justice.
Could you just sort of describe briefly this trial process,
yeah,
which is obviously a very unique situation and very unusual apparatus for bringing some understanding and reconciliation?
Yeah, no, of course, yeah. Well, in 1994, in Rwanda, 800,000 people were murdered, most of them Tutsi tribe. And most of the murderers were from a different tribe, the Hutu tribe. And that happened, 800,000 people were murdered within the space of 3 or 4 months. So it was just an horrific, you know, crazy period of time there where the brutality was unimaginable. And eventually, 100,000 people were put into prison for committing these crimes of genocide. And when I was there in 2003, it had been 9 years since the genocide, and these 100,000 people were in prisons, and the government and the citizens, the population, didn't quite know what to do. They didn't really have the resources for trials, for traditional Western-style trials. They didn't really have the resources for investigations and trials. But they knew they had to somehow bring justice for healing purposes. They had to somehow address the trauma that was so destructive to the culture and to the country. And so they actually went back to a pre-colonial form of justice, which was called gachacha, which means meeting in the grass. And what that meant was that these 100,000 people in prison, genocidaires, they were known as, were brought to the villages where they committed the atrocities, and the families of the people they murdered came before them, pointed to them, and told the stories of what happened. And they were just brutal, horrific stories. Many of the murders were committed with machetes and with farm tools, and it was just horrific. And the goal was, when those stories were told, the genocidaires would have to also address the families. And if they admitted to what they had done, if they came clean, so to speak, often they were released back into the villages. And the expectation was that they would be forgiven.
Were the villages mixed that they went back into?
They were mixed. Yeah, they were
so
mixed.
They were going back actually to live with the.
They were going back to live with the families
with
of
the victims.
People they killed. Yeah, that's right. That's right. And you know, this happened to tens of thousands of people. Tens of thousands of accused murderers were released back into the villages. And to this day, they are living side by side with the families of the people they brutally murdered. In general, it has been successful. I mean, of course, there have been incidents and there have been some hiccups, but you know, it is an experiment in reconciliation and forgiveness, which I found to be very positive, and I found it to be, you know, something that I couldn't imagine happening anywhere else. It just felt like an amazing thing to forgive someone who had brutally murdered your husband,
yeah,
who had murdered your family.
That concept of forgiveness has always, I don't know what the right word is, bothered me, because there's got to be things that can't be forgiven.
Well, I mean, that's possibly true. I mean, I don't know. I mean, is that true? You know, I think that in this country, when someone is accused of a brutal crime, they go to prison, and you know, the idea is that they will be rehabilitated, they will be
changed. Yeah, but there's no rehabilitation.
Well, I mean, I guess you could say that. That's the goal. That's the goal, for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that, you know, I think, to me, I think every person, no matter what they've done, deserves another chance, deserves to somehow make good on their lives. You know, otherwise, I think it's very difficult to imagine society existing.
Well, that's true. That's true. I mean, I guess we all have to live together, and you have to figure out a way to do it. Do you want to talk a little bit about the sort of the concept of the show?
Yeah, sure.
And come back to the specific of the, because we talked a little bit about performance.
Yeah, absolutely.
Las Vegas is performance.
Absolutely. Well, the inspiration for this show really started when I was diagnosed with multiple myeloma, which is an incurable cancer, in 2018. That, as you can imagine, radically changed the way I looked at the world and my own life. You know, I didn't really know how much longer I would have to live. They didn't really give me a stage for the cancer, but 70% of my plasma cells were cancerous at that time, which is a lot. They desperately tried to reduce that percentage with a couple of different kinds of chemotherapy. It didn't work. And so as the months went on, it became darker and darker for me. And I began to think about time and my life and how what death meant to me. You know, because I faced the possibility of dying much sooner than I thought I would. And, you know, I really began to think about the different people and situations that I've been in that somehow were about mortality, that had mortality as kind of the main subject. And I realized that a lot of things that I've done in my life have been life or death situations. There's mm-hmm. been this life or death mm-hmm. content that I've been drawn to and I've explored in different ways. I mean, through the humanity, you know. And so the impetus for this show really was trying to come to terms with that, with my own mortality, trying to sequence some of my life and death situations I've encountered and some of the people that I've encountered in these situations and put that together as a story. So that's really where the beginning of this happened. And you know, the cancer that I have is very likely a result of living very close to the World Trade Center on 9/11 and working and photographing a lot in that area in the months afterwards. The cancer that I have is one of the most common cancers actually to come out of the World Trade Center dust. In fact, in this show, there are a few images of the dust itself, which I inhaled on that day and in the weeks afterwards. So that was kind of the beginning of this, like looking at the story of my life in the context of my cancer and looking at the life and death situations that I've explored through my career. Las Vegas. Vegas, to me, is really the most American of cities in a way. You know,
interesting. That's interesting to say that.
Yeah. You know, I feel like it's a place where you have this feeling of absolute freedom that is in the context of absolute capitalism. It's a really a transactional place. It's all about transaction. Mm-hmm. You know, and the people who are drawn to that place are caught in this transactional environment, and they become part of it. They become somehow performers, imposters in a way. I mean, imposter mm-hmm. sounds like a cruel negative word in a way. Mm-hmm. Like, I wish there was a better word that would come to mind, but I really fell in love with them as I lived there. I lived there for about 4 months in 2000. I've gone back a few times. In fact, I was married in Las Vegas.
Oh, really?
In the mid-90s. In 1990,
where were you married there?
I was married at this place called the Little Church of the West, uh-huh. which was it wasn't an Elvis chapel, it was just a little church, you know, on the highway there, you know, and...
Did you just stop in, or what?
Actually, no, it wasn't an elopement. I had a couple of friends come from Los Angeles, my parents were there, actually, so it was a real wedding, but it was, you know, a Vegas wedding. Yeah, it was a really cool Vegas wedding. Actually, the marriage lasted about 6 years.
That's a Vegas wedding.
That's a Vegas wedding, yeah. But I was really attracted to Vegas, and I've been back there several times since. And in 2000, I spent a lot of time there and met some extraordinary people. You know, in the show, the two main symbols to me of Las Vegas, are Graham Patrick, who was just an uncanny Elvis impersonator. I mean, you think about an Elvis impersonator is somebody who's kind of cheesy and you know, with the sweat rags and, you know, and the sequins. But this guy was a young Elvis, and his performance was electrifying, and he could sing just like Elvis. And after the show, he performed at Harrah's Casino, and after the show, he would come out, and there would be 100 people waiting for him to touch him, to get him to sign an autograph, and he had become Elvis Presley. And I just thought that was brilliant. Amazing. Of course, he wanted to be his own person. He wanted to be a singer in his own right, and he was really trapped in the persona of Elvis. He has since gone on to gain a lot of weight, and now he's playing Fat Elvis in Germany, which is incredible. I would love to make a documentary about him sometime, because it's an amazing story. Yeah, it's an amazing story. So, you know, Vegas to me was just a fascinating microcosm of America that I love, and I can't wait to go back there, actually.
Yeah, I've been there a couple of times. You walk into the airport and you're confronted with slots.
Yeah, exactly.
And you can gamble the taxis also, right?
Yes, that's right. That's right.
It is a bizarre place.
That's right.
So the mug shots.
Yeah.
Tell me about those, because is there a precedent for those other than police?
Well, I think, you know, I've always been really fascinated by mugshots. I'm a collector of antique photography. I have a couple of different collections. One of them is mugshots that I collect from all the way from the 19th century, when they began to be used as identification purposes, up through really the 60s and 70s. I have a particularly strong collection of Tulsa, Oklahoma, in the 40s. I've got hundreds of images from that time.
How did you buy
them through eBay, flea markets.
What are they? They're photographs?
Photographs.
They're photographs.
Yeah.
And are the people who are selling them realize they have value?
They do, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they do.
Are they sort of Walker Evans kinds of?
I mean, they're just very basic, almost like artless. Mm-hmm. You could say they're just identification mm-hmm. photographs, basically. Mm-hmm. Usually it's one sheet with a frontal shot and a profile shot.
Yeah, I love those things.
Yeah, they're great. They're great. And, you know, one of the things I've always been fascinated by is the fact that even though these images were for identification purposes, you get so much character
yes.
in them. I mean, you see someone who's caught at a place in their life which is...
They don't want to be,
you know. So you get a lot of character. Yeah. You get a lot of who they are in those shots. And so I became really interested in that idea, using a form of photography that is really for identification purposes as a way to express identity and to explore identity. So that's something that I began to play around with a bit. And when I was in Baltimore, embedded with the Baltimore Homicide Unit in 2000, I began to use this technique with the police and also with some of the people that they brought in, which made a lot of sense. And then from there, it just kind of expanded into a technique that I used all over the world. And so I've done probably thousands of mugshots, which have been combined in the film Contact and a book project as well.
Just to change the subject a little bit, are there filmmakers now that you're particularly interested in?
I was really inspired by Godard and the French New Wave.
Mm-hmm. When
I was in film school, yeah, particularly the directness of it, the storytelling techniques, for sure. These days, I'm very interested more in the documentary world, because documentary filmmaking has become so much more sophisticated. You know, it's become so much more related to narrative filmmaking, really. And it's something that, you know, I've explored somewhat in my filmmaking work.
This is sort of, in a sense, a retrospective. I mean, it covers a fairly significant period of your work.
Yeah, it really does. I do see it as a retrospective, for sure. It's really 20 years of work, over 20 years of work. I think this is true for a lot of people. Time has become compressed. Time has mm-hmm. kind of stood still in a way. And I feel like it's really interesting to me to like have this, all of these things shot over many years in one place. It's all one moment. It's all kind of one thing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's all bringing me up to the current day, which I think is really interesting.
So what's next? What's coming?
I have a couple of projects right now. One of them is a film project, a documentary that I can't really talk about very much. But I also have a couple of still photo projects. One of them is doing portraits of spiritual leaders. I'm right now in the process of researching and doing outreach. Of course, it's been hard to travel recently, but hopefully soon I'll be able to. But the idea that a photograph, which is essentially essentially a depiction of something that's exterior on the outside. Somehow, it's telling you what's on the inside. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a spirituality to the mugshot and what I try to achieve in portraiture, and I'm very interested in what that means for holy men and women. You know, what does that mean? How do I portray that? There are a few of those in the film, in the book Contact, and in the film Contact, there are a few spiritual leaders. One of them is this amazing guru I met in rural India, and you really feel it emanating from him. Mm-hmm. You know, what is that all about? Like, how do you capture someone's spirituality through seeing what's on the outside and not what's on the inside? Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the basis of this new project.
Well, we've covered a lot of ground.
Yes.
A lot of ground. Yeah. Thank you very much. This is a great show at the Pamela Salisbury Gallery at 362 and 1/2 Warren Street. So thank you very much. I know you're busy getting this thing up and ready to go, and you haven't got much time left.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
Take care.